Hi, everybody. My name is Matthew Lyons, and I'm going to be talking about anti-state politics on the far right. And what I wanted to do is talk about a few different sectors of the far right and the role that decentralist politics has played, including certain branches of the white nationalist movement, the Christian right, and so-called right-wing anarchist groups, including particularly national anarchists. And then talk a little bit about how, in some cases, some of these folks have made overtures toward sectors of the left for some kind of coalition work or coming together, and how leftists have responded to that. And I also want to try to look a bit at the question of, you know, why is this happening? Why is there this phenomenon of political decentralism, anti-state politics in sectors of the far right in ways that sometimes look really strange? Where does that come from, and what does it mean? So I'm going to be kind of touching on a lot of different things, and I want to, you know, kind of cover all that and then leave a whole bunch of time later for questions and comments and discussion. So let me say a little bit about myself. I have been studying and writing about right-wing and particularly far-right politics for a long time. about a quarter century. And I think back particularly, one of the things that kind of got me to focus on this issue was in 1990, during the lead up to the first U.S.-Iraq war. I was living in Ithaca, New York, and a number of us were kind of shocked to discover that one of the founders of the little anti-war group that we were part of was a supporter of Lyndon LaRouche, who, as many people may know, is a very kind of quirky far-right cult leader who specializes in fairly arcane conspiracy theories. And we were further shocked and dismayed to learn that this was not just sort of an isolated thing, but was part of a coordinated effort around the country by LaRouche supporters to be part of the anti-Gulf War movement and build alliances with leftists and liberals around this issue. So it seemed to me that this was something that was, it didn't fit people's assumptions about what right-wing politics meant. And it certainly didn't fit my notions about it, and it needed some more attention and needed some more explanation. So I've been trying to explore this kind of issue in different ways over the years, and look particularly at the ways that sectors of the far right present themselves as progressive or as at least speaking to leftist concerns in ways that are often confusing and need some attention. One other thing I wanted to just say about this evening before I get into the substance of it is it's common in some political meetings to say at the outset that if there are any representatives of governmental security services present in an information gathering capacity, please identify yourselves and please leave. And I'd like to extend that in this case also to representatives of far-right organizations, because there have been instances where some far-right groups, particularly national anarchists, have sent folks to leftist events. in ways that are really problematic. And this is not intended as a debate. It's not intended as a forum for getting into any sort of altercation, certainly. But there is a safety issue here in a couple of ways. As I will be explaining, national anarchists represent a number of forms of bigotry against people of color, women, LGBT folks, Jews, and others, in ways that directly affect a lot of people in this room. And also, the founder of National Anarchism has urged his followers, his supporters, to secretly infiltrate other political organizations in order to either take them over or use them as recruiting grounds or disrupt them. So, that said, this is not a space where we want that to be happening. All right, I want to go through a few different sectors of the right and talk about them in turn. First of all, I've used the term far right, and I think I should explain what I mean by that, because people use it in different ways. And I'm sort of trying this out. This is not intended as like a universal definition, but looking at the far right in the U.S. at this historical moment, I see two things as central. One is far-right groups are groups that reject the principle of human equality and that regard social hierarchy or exclusion of whole social groups as kind of a basic part of the natural order. And then the other thing is far-right groups reject the legitimacy of the established political system. That doesn't necessarily mean that they're literally, taking up arms, although some of them have done that, but it means that they are in some sense or another attempting to bring about either the overthrow of the U.S. government or to secede from it. So these are groups that are not simply like a more extreme version of conservatism, but really represent something that's qualitatively different. And this comes back to what I was saying earlier about how many far-right groups take on certain characteristics that look progressive, look leftist, and that at different times may include anti-imperialist positions, critiques of global capitalism, of U.S. intervention overseas, ecological politics, in some cases even certain twisted forms of feminist politics. And also certain kinds of decentralist politics, as we're going to be seeing. The first sector of the far right that I want to talk about is the white nationalists. And I'm going to... I had a bunch of images and quotes that I thought I could just sort of pull together. So it's... I hope the slides are not distracting. I hope that they help give you a sense. White revolution, the only solution. The white supremacist movement of the 20th century, up until like the 1980s, was really focused in this country, focused primarily on, defending Jim Crow segregation and the sort of traditional Ku Klux Klan style terrorism. And in the 1980s, there was a real change. Traditionally, these groups had, in many cases, worked more or less closely with law enforcement, either on the local level or, in some cases, at the federal level. But in the 1980s, you started to have a real change. And all of a sudden, there were a lot of groups that started talking about revolution, and not in just sort of a rhetorical way, but in some cases literally going underground, taking up arms, having shootouts with federal marshals, robbing banks, assassinating people and declaring war on the U.S. government. And this went along with a shift of ideology from a kind of traditional segregationism to various kinds of fascist politics. But it wasn't necessarily the kind of old style Hitler or Mussolini fascism of, you know, the strong state and, you know, cult of the leader and this kind of thing. But it took a lot of different forms. And decentralism was one of the things that was striking in this process. This is a bumper sticker for Posse Comitatus, which is a group that started in the late 60s and really kind of got big in the 70s and the early 80s, and was kind of a forerunner of the Patriot movement of the 1990s and later. Posse Comitatus is a movement that says it is a white supremacist and anti-Semitic movement that says that any governmental institutions above the county level are illegitimate, that the county is the basic governmental level that's valid in this country. And this is based in a very sort of arcane, legalistic mumbo-jumbo, but they're pretty serious about it. And it's tied in with all kinds of conspiracy theories about, you know, the Federal Reserve. I mean, you see Take Back the USA, abolish the Federal Reserve, not subject to corporate federal or corporate state jurisdiction. In the early 80s, one of the first martyrs of the white nationalist movement was Gordon Call, who was a Posse Comitatus leader, who got in a firefight with federal marshals who were trying to arrest him for tax evasion, and then eventually was killed in a second firefight. This is a quote from a letter that he wrote shortly before he died. "We are a conquered and occupied nation, conquered and occupied by the Jews and their hundreds or maybe thousands of front organizations doing their ungodly work." As I say, this group was kind of a forerunner of the Patriot movement, although the Patriot movement is a more diverse movement. It's much larger, and it includes people who have basically this ideology and then others who are kind of, you know, not going to sign on to all of the racial ideology, but certainly are in accord with the anti-government message. All right, another thread in this dynamic was the idea of leaderless resistance, which was promoted in the starting in the early 80s by a fellow named Louis Beam, who had been the grand dragon of the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan in Texas. He split off from the Klan and joined the Aryan Nations, which was a more kind of neo-Nazi-oriented organization. And this was at a time when a number of Klan leaders were moving toward more Nazi politics. And the idea of leaderless resistance was something which had actually come out of a proposal for anti-communist guerrilla warfare during the Cold War. And Beam said, well, at that time we saw the communists as the main enemy, but now it's the Zionist occupation government. It is the people in Washington who are the main enemy, and so we need to refocus our resistance struggle. And he said the traditional pyramid structure of organizing warfare is too vulnerable to infiltration. It's too difficult to maintain. So we are going to be more effective if we have a decentralized approach, which he compared to the way that the American Revolution was organized. This is a quote: "Since the entire purpose of leaderless resistance is to defeat state tyranny, all members of phantom cells or individuals will tend to react to objective events in the same way through usual tactics of resistance. No one need issue an order to anyone. Those idealists truly committed to the cause of freedom will act when they feel the time is right, or will take their cues from others who precede them." Now, he did not make the connection, but I mean, to me, there's a lot of parallels with the concept of the affinity group as developed by the Spanish anarchists in the 1930s and others, but in a radically different political context. Another thread that I think is important here is that during this time, you started to have all kinds of proposals among white nationalists for breaking up the United States, taking this huge political structure and splitting off from it. And there were all kinds of different proposals. Some people wanted to set up something in the South, and some people in the mountain regions. One of the most common was in the Northwest. So this is one version of that. Northwest Front, Our Race is Our Nation. As you can see from the graphic, it's basically Washington State, Oregon, Idaho, and part of Montana. So that was one version of this idea of forming an all-white homeland that would be a refuge for true patriots in the face of Zionist occupation. I'm going to turn now to the Christian right, and I want to look particularly at one sector of the Christian right, which is Christian Reconstructionism. Christian right is a huge movement, and it has some basic principles in common. I mean, it is basically about imposing a certain very repressive version of Christian morality on society as a whole, with a particular focus on intensifying patriarchy and heterosexism, but also reaching into a lot of other areas. But there's real differences of strategy within the movement about how you do that. And the biggest organizations, the Moral Majority, Christian Coalition, Focus on the Family, groups like this, have basically taken the approach: we want to work within the Republican Party, we want to take over the U.S. government and work within the existing system. But then there have also been those who said, no, we need to get rid of the existing system and create something that's radically new. We need to create a theocracy. Or as the Reconstructionists call it, theonomy. Christian Reconstructionism is a very extreme offshoot of Calvinism that started in the 1960s and basically says that Christian men have a responsibility to take over all areas of society and remake them in terms of their particular version of biblical law. So you would, for example, establish a death penalty for homosexuality, for women being unfaithful to their husbands, for children disobeying their parents, all these kinds of things. But one thing that's different about Reconstructionism is that, when I think about a theocracy, typically I think about a very centralized system. And their notion of theocracy is not centralized. It says we would, society would be run according to these principles, but the power would be exercised primarily through local institutions, especially the church and the family, the patriarchal family. This is a picture of Gary North, who's one of the kind of leading ideologues in the movement. This is a quote. We must use the doctrine of religious liberty to gain independence for Christian schools until we train up a generation of people who know that there is no religious neutrality, no neutral law, no neutral education, and no neutral civil government. Then they will get busy in constructing a Bible-based social, political, and religious order which finally denies the religious liberty of the enemies of God. So, you know, they're pretty upfront about this. This is kind of a model of the Reconstructionist notion of the family. And there's a whole movement of biblical patriarchy which extends far beyond Reconstructionists alone to many other Christian fundamentalists and evangelicals. But, you know, the husband is subservient to Christ and the wife is subservient to the husband. Doug Phillips, who's the son of Howard Phillips, another well-known Reconstructionist leader. This is from a talk that he gave to a homeschoolers convention some years ago. Can you call your husband Lord? If the answer is no, you shouldn't get married. I mean, it's really the idea that women, for women to make any kind of significant decisions on their own is selfish and against God. This is sort of some of the imagery. Created to be his helpmeet, discover how God can make your marriage glorious. And then on the other side, family man, family leader, biblical fatherhood as the key to a thriving family. So this is all against centralized government. So it's saying, you know, we're not about big government. We're not about taking over the White House and so on. What we're about is this kind of very granular, local, decentralized system of domination and repression. This is an example of the ideal family in the Reconstructionist model. I mean, there's a whole subsection of the biblical patriarchy movement which is dedicated to, you know, having as many children as possible. And that's this is an example of sort of a prize-winning family. All right, I want to, one other thing is the Reconstructionists have been one of the pivotal forces in the most extreme, most violent wing of the anti-abortion movement. The folks who firebomb women's health clinics have engaged in assassination against doctors and other abortion providers. One of the main organizations involved in this is a loose network called the Army of God. The slogan, get ready to fight for holiness and righteousness. This group has been around for about 30 years. They still exist. They have a website. It's pretty scary. All right, now I want to look at right-wing anarchism. National anarchism is a movement that started in the 1990s. In the English-speaking world, at least, it was started by a guy named Troy Southgate, who was a veteran of the British neo-Nazi movement. He was active in the National Front, and then when that split up, was involved in a couple of different splinter groups within that. And then at a certain point, he said, we've been looking at, you know, various kinds of, you know, white revolution and, you know, going beyond the old sort of left-right paradigm, that the notion of third position was very much in the mix, this idea that we need to reject both communism and capitalism and create a third alternative. That's a very common idea in neo-Nazi circles. He said, but, you know, we even need to go beyond that. And so, you know, the Nazis classically called themselves National Socialists. I mean, that's what Nazism stands for. It's an abbreviation. We're going to say National Anarchist. Take it a step further. This shift was very much influenced by a movement in Europe called the European New Right, which was a, and still is, a project, kind of an intellectual movement to kind of reshape fascist ideology. It was started in the 1960s by people in far-right intellectuals in France and elsewhere who realized that the kind of old-style fascism was not going to be very effective at winning people over on any sort of large scale. And so they needed to come up with a different approach. And so they said, for example, rather than pushing ethnic supremacism and, you know, the master race, we are in favor of promoting diversity. We're in favor of ethno-pluralism. We want to simply make sure that Europeans have the ability to preserve their cultural heritage in the same way that everybody else does. It's very clever. And it had a big effect on impact on Southgate and others who created national anarchism. Now, a related group in the U.S. Is Attack the System, which also goes by the name American Revolutionary Vanguard. Attack the System is the website. And this is started by a fellow named Keith Preston. Now, unlike Southgate, who was, you know, as I said, a neo-Nazi veteran, Preston is a former leftist. He was involved in the IWW and a couple of other left-wing anarchist groups in the 80s. And he had a change of heart and moved very far to the right, but has continued to kind of incorporate elements of leftist politics in his political philosophy. He works very closely with national anarchists. There's certain differences. The national anarchists they call themselves tribalist. He calls himself more of an individualist. There's certain things like that. But they work together closely. And I wanted to include this quote because this brings out a lot of the sort of European New Right influence I was referring to. It's kind of hard to read, but anarchists of the right emphasize the particular and champion the sovereignty, autonomy, and preservation of unique cultures, regions, ethnicities, identities, faiths, and tribes against the homogenizing and universalizing forces of the global economy, technology, and imperialism. Sounds pretty good, right? You know? I mean, what's there to argue with that, right? That sounds like stuff that, you know, a lot of people could get behind. It's when you kind of dig further and see what that means in substantive terms that it starts to get ugly. All right, now this is another dimension of it. Pan-anarchism against the state, pan-secessionism against the empire. Attack the System uses this slogan a lot, and the National Anarchist Movement does also. Again, we see a lot of this kind of reworking of far-right themes in a way that's going to be much more appealing. Freedom without judgment, diversity without globalization, acceptance without universalism, community without coercion, culture without supremacism, sovereignty without statism, organization without politics, and free markets without capitalism. Now, you know, okay, I mean, you know, somebody might say, well, I don't know about that last one, but, you know, maybe some of those others don't sound too bad. And this is an example of, you know, one vision of pan-secessionism for the United States. These different flags along the top and the bottom represent actual secessionist movements or organizations in the United States. Along the top you have Hawaii, then you have Lakota Nation, the green flag with the blue and white corner, that's supposed to be Republic of Vermont, and then the other one is for Libertarian New Hampshire. And along the bottom you have secessionist movements for Alaska and Texas and Louisiana, and then I guess the last one is probably Christian Exodus, which is a movement to form a kind of Christian Reconstructionist style independent state in the South.
That middle one looks like a black nationalist flag.
Yes, actually, you're right. The Louisiana one is, yeah, you're right. It's a black nationalist flag. So part of what they're saying is, we're not just about, you know, right-wing politics. We're about everybody who is opposed to the empire, against U.S. imperialism and the existing system. There's room for all of us. We can work together and dismantle the empire if we pool our resources. And so, they're trying to position themselves as the ones who are being inclusive and tolerant and welcoming, and not like you bigoted, narrow-minded leftists who, you know, are being exclusionary. All right, now let's get into what some of this means in practice. This is from the National Anarchist Movement Manifesto. This is one of various quotes I could have used. Race defines who we are. It provides us with an identity and exists for a damn good reason. Without maintaining this essential diversity, something you can find throughout nature, the world will become increasingly drab, standardized, and monotonous. National anarchists wish to preserve the different races of the earth and believe that multiracialism ends with the dissolution of all races. Racial separatism is the only way that the organic balance can be restored. So their basic model is, we want to subdivide society into ethnically pure communities and enclaves. If you want to have an enclave for your ethnic community, that's fine. You can go over and do it over there. We just want to make sure that we can do that for white people, for Europeans, like this. And yet, clearly, it's not simply about respecting all groups. There is a basic underlying racial ideology here, racist ideology that is at work. This is a direct attack on people of mixed race background. It is saying that we are going to create a society that's based on excluding people.
It sounds scientifically ridiculous.
Yes.
Misunderstanding.
We could get into a whole discussion about just how the concept of race is a social construct and is biologically arbitrary and meaningless. Yes. Now here, it's a really interesting imagery that you get from this movement. Smash the thought Nazis for a real social alternative. The National Anarchists. This is in Australia, New Zealand National Anarchist Group. And then here's another quote from the National Anarchist Manifesto. This is from right near the beginning. National anarchists do not hate ordinary Jews, and neither do we wish to undermine them as a people. What we will not tolerate is the ongoing enslavement of our people by a minority of vampire parasites intent on carving up the world's resources in an attempt to create a single global market. The manifesto, the first section after the introduction is labeled anti-Zionism. This comes before the section on anarchism. It's very interesting. And what they call anti-Zionism it's not what I mean by anti-Zionism. It basically is saying there is a conspiracy of rich Jews to control the world. I mean, it is propaganda that is lifted directly from standard, classic anti-Jewish conspiracy theory, such as the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. And, you know, so that's right there front and center as part of the founding principles of the movement. This is a quote from Troy Southgate, who, as I said, is the founder. This is from an interview that he gave some years ago. Feminism is dangerous and unnatural because it ignores the complementary relationship between the sexes and encourages women to rebel against their inherent feminine instincts. Homosexuality is contrary to the natural order because sodomy is quite undeniably an unnatural act. National anarchists will sometimes say, you know, when we're carving up society into all these different enclaves, you know, if, you know, homosexuals want to go and have an enclave over there, that's fine. They can do that as long as they don't bother us, you know. And so there's, you know, there's this notion that, you know, we're being tolerant. It's all live and let live. And yet if you, you know, if you see what that actually means, it's based on vilification of whole groups of people. I was also struck by the imagery of this, the poster up here on the left. I mean, it actually reminds me a lot of the Christian right kind of imagery that we were seeing earlier. Here's another one. So on the left, abolish capitalism, smash the state, National Anarchist Movement. Sounds good, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I think is really important to understand about the National Anarchists and also about Attack the System is that anarchism to them is not about facilitating human equality. It's not about liberating the capacity for all people to live full and productive lives. It is about facilitating an underlying natural hierarchy that is integral to human nature. As the manifesto says, to suppose that humans are somehow equal is quite ridiculous. Humanity, like the rest of nature, is hierarchical. And the left's progressive fantasies about a world in which everyone acquires the same rank inevitably manifests itself in a leveling process in which oppressive laws are used to drag the strong down to the level of the most weak and resentful. National anarchists sometimes like to refer back to a German theorist named Ernst Jünger, who was part of the conservative revolutionary movement in the 1920s and early 30s. It was sort of like a far-right alternative to Nazism. I mean, he regarded the Nazis as not elitist enough. and later on, he developed the idea of the anarch, which was somebody who could just live, exist independently of the state and not have to, you know, sort of be bothered with the dynamic of either following or resisting the state structures, and it was this notion of a very selective elite group of people, not a notion of transforming society for everyone. This is another quote, and this is a lot of words, but I thought this was important. Again, this is Keith Preston, who of Attack the System, self-described fellow traveler of National Anarchism. Within the bleak framework of a perpetual war of each against all, there from time to time arises the exceedingly rare individual whom Nietzsche referred to as the Übermensch, which literally means Superman, superperson. This is the individual of superior will, strength, mind, spirit, discipline, intelligence, intuition, perceptiveness, shrewdness, wisdom, creativity, inventiveness, generosity, and other such characteristics that set the human species a half step above other animals. It is this individual who becomes the anarch, the egoist, the one who rises above the perpetual fog in which both the sheepish people and their vicious masters dwell. It is persons such as these who carry with them the seeds of cultural and civilizational growth. For any sort of human existence to emerge beyond that of the merely animalistic, this type of individual must thrive. So this is not about freeing humanity as a collective, as a totality. This is about taking a very select, elite minority and letting them thrive. That's what separates us from bestial, you know, animalistic existence. So that, to me, is, you know, I mean, yeah, you could call that, if it's about dismantling the state, you could call that anarchism. But it is a fundamentally different notion of anarchism than than certainly what, you know, I'm familiar with from the leftist tradition. Now, This goes back to something that I mentioned in my introduction. Troy Southgate wrote an essay called The Case for National Anarchist Entryism, which is about this idea of infiltrating groups. And he defines it here. Entryism is the name given to the process of entering or infiltrating bona fide organizations, institutions, and political parties with the intention of either gaining control of them for their own for our own ends, misdirecting or disrupting them for our own purposes, or converting sections of their membership to our cause. And in the essay, he goes into a lot of detail, just sort of explaining how national anarchists should go about doing this by, you know, sort of joining a group and being quiet about their politics, and then, you know, 6 months later, they can start to bring up some issues, bring a couple more people in, get into a kind of fake argument with them to sort of lull people into a sense of security. And it's just very elaborate. And it's all based on this idea of we will use deception to take over these groups. And, you know, I mean, he does make the point that certain left groups have used this, which is actually true. I would not want to have anything to do with those particular groups either. But it's sort of like, you know, I mean, people have, you know, talked about, you know, I mean, the Christian Reconstructionists, they want to dismantle public education, you know, privatize education. I mean, this is about, you know, sort of anarcho-quintelpro. I mean, it's like taking the functions of security services and you know, reappropriating them in an anarchist context. All right, I want to time check here. All right, I want to talk a bit about the ways that some of these groups have related to the left, and there's a lot that we could get into here. I'm just going to say a couple of things briefly for now. Over the last several decades, there have been many different efforts by various sectors of the far right to work with leftists in some capacity or other, either in an open way or in a covert way. You know, I mentioned the example of the anti-Gulf War movement in the early 1990s. You know, with the second Gulf War, you saw that again. The anti-globalization movement, the mass protests in Seattle in 1999, and other mass activism. I mean, that was another example where many far-rightists said, "Hey, we are against global capitalism too." You know, we support that. And then, you know, a major recent example is the Occupy movement. There were a lot of, well, I mean, there were a lot of right-wingers who hated the Occupy actions, but there were a number of far-rightists who supported them or were got involved or, you know, tried to do sort of parallel initiatives of some kind or another. And it was the kind of movement where it was so free form that there were a lot of opportunities to do that. And since many far right groups see bankers and finance capital as, you know, a major enemy, I mean, there was a lot of potential for that. This particular slide, it's a event by the American Freedom Party. No more foreign wars, but also American jobs for American workers, just in case you thought they were some kind of internationalists. And in terms of the what I'm talking about this evening, I think there's kind of a couple different issues or sort of set of dynamics. I mean, there's kind of a generalized notion that, you know, we're against the empire and you're against the empire, and even though we hate each other, let's work together, you know. And that doesn't have anything to do necessarily with, you know, we believe in decentralism or anything like that. It's just, you know, I mean the Lindja and the Rouge people, they are not at all about dismantling government, but they certainly have repeatedly tried to work with leftists around these kind of issues. and then the other dynamic is specifically groups that present themselves as anarchists and say, you know, you call yourselves anarchists, we call ourselves anarchists, we're part of the same movement, we should work together, you should welcome us. That's a different kind of issue, because there it's decentralism that is being presented as the point of unity. And I think that, I mean, in the first case, leftists have responded in a variety of ways. I mean, there have been some leftists who have said, yes, we want to work with you. We believe that, you know, it's more, the struggle against the common enemy outweighs the differences that we have with you. I think Alex Coburn, the late Marxist intellectual, is an example of this. And you still see this represented in Counterpunch, which is the online and I guess print journal that he co-founded, where they, you know, I mean, they're generally positioned as a leftist organ, but they routinely publish stuff by right-wingers, including some pretty vile folks. And that's just, it's part of their notion of coalition building. I think what's more common is diverse movements where right-wingers come in and leftists don't really know who they are or what they're about, and so it's just kind of like, I don't know how to respond, you know. And I think that was something that happened in some sections of Occupy. I mean, there were some places in Occupy where right-wingers came in and people said, whoa, you know, this is scary, and it, you know, we're gonna confront this. But then there was a lot of other places where it was, it didn't work that way, and there was no, for example, baseline of, you know, basic principles that people could turn to and say, you know, if you're promoting anti-Jewish conspiracy theories, that's not okay. You know, if you're promoting homophobia, that's not okay. So that was an issue that I think some people recognize that, you know, we need to address better than has been the case. And then there have been other instances where, please, thank you. Instances where people have responded in a very clear and direct and well thought out way and saying, you know, no, we're not going to work with you, and we don't want to have anything to do with you, and you're not welcome here. this is an example of it's a screenshot of a YouTube video from a couple of people in the Attack the System network. It's a video called "Power to the Neighborhoods: A Message to Occupy Wall Street," and I think their own blurb sums it up pretty well. A message to Occupy Wall Street, tailored to the mainstream left, focused on transcending the left-right spectrum for the purpose of revolution by means of pan-secessionism and decentralizing politics and economics into a system of decentralized cities, towns, and neighborhoods where groups of all political persuasions can achieve self-determination. And if you look at it, it cites various leftist thinkers and activists and so on. But when it comes to actually the solutions, you know, how are we going to grapple with these problems? It's all from the right. So I just thought it's a pretty telling example. Now, as far as I know, there certainly hasn't been leftists rallying to their invitation of, working together. Now here's another example. This is from the New York City Antifa website about an incident where, I guess this was last year, national anarchists came and tried to join the Anarchist Book Fair and were turned away, were made unwelcome. And so the New York City Antifa had a whole write-up about it, and this is just from their conclusion. Hopefully soon the members of National Anarchist Tribal Alliance New York will realize the more they show their faces, the less welcome they will be in any political circle in New York, and they will give up their facade of an anarchist group and join the fight for a world without ethnic divisions or nations. Right. Lastly, I want to just offer a few thoughts about why we're seeing this kind of decentralism on the right. And, I mean, I don't want to say that national anarchists are any sort of mass movement. I mean, they're a pretty small group, but I think that they do offer the potential for something that could, either in whole or in some elements, be taken up by others on the far right as a way to attract more support. So I do think they are worth taking seriously, along with the other groups that I mentioned. The first thing I want to say is that I think all of these examples drive home to me the point that hierarchy and oppression are about much more than the state, much more than large centralized state, but much more than any kind of state. I mean, if you can envision a theocracy that's based on the family, it has to go further than attacking the state. I think that there are certain features of U.S. history that lend themselves to this kind of politics. From the colonial period on, the U.S. power structure has always relied on decentralized groups of armed men to enforce order. The slave patrols, lynch mobs, the militia units on the border that were fighting Indians. These are not disciplined, centrally created or directed organs of state power, but they have been vital for maintaining the system of racial oppression and the system of economic oppression that the U.S. has been based on for centuries. Also, I think that the way that big business developed in the United States it has been more decentralized and less reliant on the central state than in many countries. Mike Davis, Marxist author, makes the point that you know, in contrast with, you know, say France, where you had one major hub where business was concentrated, in the U.S. there have been many different regional hubs, and so it's been a very fragmented, geographically fragmented ruling class. And also, I mean, through the 19th century and well into the 20th century, the business elite relied very heavily on private security forces more than they did on the state. I have an image here, Pinkerton guards escorting strikebreakers in Ohio in 1884. This was at a time when, I mean, the Pinkertons started as a detective agency, but were, you know, this was their main job, was breaking strikes and attacking organized labor during this time. In the late 19th century, there were more Pinkerton guards under arms than there were soldiers in the U.S. Army. I mean, I think that, you know, kind of, and that's just one private organization here. I mean, it's just, you know, the idea that capitalist repression is synonymous with the state just really doesn't work. The second thing is that there have been various recent developments that I think intensified the push toward decentralized politics on the right. I mean, first of all, you know, I mentioned how the European New Right sort of took on this project of reworking fascist ideology. I mean, this was, you know, after World War II, just the whole idea of fascism had been, you know, tremendously discredited for most people. So there were all kinds of efforts to rework far-right politics in one way or another. And the European New Right was a very kind of conscious, deliberate process. And in the U.S., it was more sort of a, you know, free-form, organic process that, you know, created things like Posse Comitatus and so on. And then I think also the end of the Cold War played into this also, the end of the... 1989, the Berlin Wall came down. This is Louis Beam again. His newsletter called The Seditionist, he's talking about, you know, now that the former main enemy of communism is at least on the decline, what will be the issue of main concern for conservatives, right-wingers, and nationalists in the U.S.? You know, I mean, his answer was, you know, it should be overthrowing the government in Washington. And that, you know, I mean, not that every right-wing anti-communist agreed with that, but certainly that moment fragmented old right-wing alliances, and you started to see a whole bunch of people drawn into white nationalism who had not been before. People drawn into, you know, as I mentioned before, the Patriot Movement, which, you know, really kind of exploded in the 1990s, and other movements like the Neo-Confederate Movement, anti-immigrant movement, and death of anti-communism was part of that. And I think also the just coming out of the 1960s, where, you know, one of the things that happened was the, you know, because of the pressure from the civil rights movement and the women's movement and the various other progressive grassroots movements, the federal government started to undertake certain measures that directly confronted certain forms of traditional hierarchy, such as the Voting Rights Act, saying, you know, we are actually going to get serious about allowing black people to vote in the South. That was a real turning point. Roe v. Wade, Supreme Court decision, legalizing many forms of abortion. That was a real turning point. The 1965 Immigration Reform Act, which, you know, for the first time in U.S. history, created something that started to approximate a fair set of rules about, you know, who from which countries could come and move to the United States. That was a real turning point. And then also you started in this time to see a real increase in federal government regulation of business in certain areas, such as environmental law and occupational health and safety. And so, you know, now some of those things have been eroded or scaled back, and it's certainly not, you know, it's not attacking problems at a fundamental level, but certainly there have been some significant shifts, and there have been sectors of the right who have said, we used to see the federal government as a force that at least some of the time was on our side. It's no longer on our side. And so I think that was another thing that played into it. And then the third thing I wanted to say, and this is where I will close, is that the far right of the 1920s was a creature of its times, the 1920s and 1930s. The far right of today is a creature of different times. In the 1920s, you had, you know, still whole movements about forming and consolidating nation states in much of Europe and in other parts of the world. You had still large colonial empires. You had industry based on massive factories and, you know, large-scale production units. And the far-right movements that developed in this time spoke to those realities and reflected those realities. This is a different time. I mean, this is a time where, you know, global capitalism is all about mobility and fragmentation and reconfiguring things and eroding old structures and ways of doing things. And, you know, you have organizations putting out failed states index to measure how the existing state structures are eroding or failing to function. And yet, business is still functioning and is finding ways to navigate this reality, and sometimes at great profit. So, I mean, just in very broad terms, I do think that having far-right groups that are not wedded to big centralized nation states is, in some sense, both a reflection of this new reality and an effort to meet it, to address it in some way. I think that it's something that is, it's not simply, you know, sort of a fleeting phenomenon, but it's something that's going to continue to be with us and develop.